Hello, and welcome to The Big Snore. In each episode, I will read a passage from a book, an article, a magazine that runs about 15 to 20 minutes. You can choose to listen to this as a bedtime story or just a story at any time of the day. Today, the passage I'm reading is from Andrew Hunter Murray's novel, The Sanctuary. My first step was the public coach station in the city center. The trains were down as usual. The building had been handsome once. Halfway up the walls was a beautiful frieze, a century old, now almost totally concealed by a jammed-in mezzanine. The scent of the food shacks up there arced high into the roof and then down onto the crowd, a great spiced wave of heat. The station had only reopened the previous day after 4 days of public mourning. The livery of official grief was everywhere. The four large government boards overlooking the station showed a diptych of the departed king's face beside that of his cool, self-assured daughter. The city's principal newspaper, never far from full self-abasement, had edged its stands in black crepe, and the bazaars around the ground floor had produced official keepsakes with amazing speed. Nala the elephant had been relegated to the higher shelves. Almost everyone I saw in the station seemed to be in mourning too. To me, they resembled a huge company of aging crows, bereft of their leader, uncertain which way to fly next. The people around me, overwhelmingly older than me, most by more than 20 years, would have seen the king grow, shared his sorrows and joys, felt themselves part of his life. Of course they mourned. He was more part of them than Nala had ever been. The fact that he too had lived in one of Pemberley's most exclusive villages for several months each year had effectively struck the national colors for private land, had gone unmentioned, and part of me felt disloyal for even remembering it. I would be traveling up the country on the east side, a journey I used to make a great deal due to a glut of commissions I had in the northeast a few years ago. That was how it went sometimes. You found yourself temporarily in fashion. The coach I was booked on was a non-village service, crowded and uncomfortable, but it would carry me to the northern border by night. Tomorrow, I would cross and head northwest towards the thumb of land poking into the sea closest to the land itself. I had already marked the coastal hamlet I was aiming for, Freeborn. Before leaving the flat, I had dug through my old research from before Kara left, and found a 15-year-old article about Pemberley I had tracked down at the time. It was closer to a press release than a news story. It simply said that a biography of Sir John was being written that would lay bare his first years in business. In particular, it would reveal how he had started out, how he had come by the enormous fortune he had arrived with in public life, and which he had used to begin his ascent. The book's prospective author was a journalist called Kevin Ladd, who had recently written several other biographies of plutocrats, though not as rich as Pemberley. It was to be called The Man Who Bought a Country. That was the first and last I had found about the book. My library had no record of it. I had even phoned a few secondhand booksellers asking for any evidence of it, a pre-publication copy, a leaked draft. Nothing. Perhaps it had never been published, or perhaps it had been pulped. I had not told Kara I was researching Pemberley. I was embarrassed to admit I wanted to know more about him, nor had she wanted to tell me anything herself. It had taken a fortnight after she got the job before she revealed her new employer's identity. Normally, when she took a position as an executive assistant, she would tell me with glee about whichever monster she would be working for next. Not so this time. In fact, this job had been different from the start. The interview process had lasted several weeks, with Kara speaking to progressively more senior officers in the organization before she was offered the post. And she attached a great significance to it, too. She said she finally found work that married her keen ambition with the prospect of improving the world. The coach station had a row of phones under plastic hoods, and the fourth one along worked. I had the company's mainland phone number on me, etched into the front of my sketchbook. This breached one of my rules. Nothing in the sketchbook but sketches. But I was glad I had broken it now. I would give Kara a chance. Try to let her know I was on my way. Tomorrow, trust. This is a vague noise, one I couldn't identify as a name, speaking. May I help you? The voice was pleasant and curiously unidentifiable, as if our country's 100 accents had been shaken together and smoothed into a paste. My name is Ben Parr. I'm ringing to try to get through to Kara Sharp. She's working on the island at the moment.
The island, sir?
They did this thing where you had to mention the place specifically. I don't know why. Maybe there were a dozen islands. Either way, I named it. Kara Sharp is working there in an executive role, and I'm trying to contact her. I thought about it and added, though I knew it made me sound desperate, she's my fiancé. It's important.
I'm sorry, sir. It's not possible for you to be put through today.
Even as I heard the lie or the evasion, I admired the passivity with which the woman spoke and imagined the inside of her head, a smooth place, probably, free of the jags of action and responsibility, a calm place. Why not? There's a problem with the cables at the moment. The situation is under urgent review, of course, but contact has been limited for some hours now.
I see. I can attempt to put a message through for you, sir, if you let me know where you're calling from. What is your location?
I didn't want my message to Kara to come from her employers, mediated through the company, and I certainly didn't want to tell them where I was. There was only one other thing I could try, an appeal to rank. She's actually working for John Pemberley himself at the moment, so it really is important for me to speak with her. I don't know what I had expected as a result of this little act of desperation, but it didn't work.
Everything possible is being done to repair the situation, sir. If you let me know where you're calling from, I can put you through to our nearest office.
It was as though she had never heard of Pemberley. Perhaps that was part of their training. Lots of unhinged people probably phoned claiming a close personal connection with him after all. I declined and thanked her and hung up. The number of the coach I was waiting for was shouted across the coach station. A long queue at the gate had formed almost before the manager had finished speaking. I felt in my pocket enough coins for another call or two. First, to the inquiries line to find out how many Kevin lads I might need to ring. Just two, I was told. For a few years, the man I needed had been writing for a local newspaper based in the country's east, deep in the broad, flat zone, now flooding twice a year. I asked for the location of each number, and one of them was in the right area. 4291. It was a woman's voice that answered. In the background, I heard a television set muttering. I could even match the voices from the set with the screens overhead in the coach station.
Is Kevin Ladd available, please? The journalist.
Who is this? A note of caution entered the voice, and the noise of the television snapped to nothing.
My name is Benjamin Parr. There's something I'd like to speak to him about.
I'm afraid he's passed away 2 years ago now.
This is his wife. Widow.
I mumbled condolences, and the voice replied with impatience.
That's quite all right. I keep telling them to remove his number. Clearly, they haven't managed it yet. What are you calling for, Mr. Parr? Perhaps I can help.
I'm trying to find out about one of his subjects.
On Sir John Pemberley.
There was no reply.
It's of interest to me.
Still, she said nothing, and I watched the clock in the middle of the coach station ticking around for 10 full seconds before I spoke again. It seems like he never wrote the book in the end, but I just wonder.
The voice cut across me then, its tone now one of brutal fury.
When will you people give up?
I'm sorry?
When will you stop? My husband is dead. I burned his papers. Nothing remains of the work, for Christ's sake.
Please, I think there's been a...
There was no stopping the voice. Years of his life taken away from him. You can't take anything else away from me, because you already took him. And I only regret that I followed his wishes and burned his papers. Because if I could do anything to you in return for what you did to him...
Mrs. Ladd, please, please.
It was no use. The voice started swearing, and then the phone was slammed down with extraordinary violence. I called back, but I was met only with the engaged tone. I noticed, as I hung up, that the hand with which I held the phone was shaking. The queue for the coach was somewhat diminished, but from where I stood, I could see a group of workers at the front holding it up. Some query over authentication. I had time for one final call. After some confusion, I got through to the woman who'd been named in the news story as the editor of Ladd's forthcoming biography. Abigail Turner was her name, and her voice was warm and deep, starting to crack with age. From her voice alone, I knew she would be enjoyable to paint. I pictured her in a corner office, now nearing the end of a long career and enjoying all the indiscretions of her trade as her right. Like a barrel of wasps or an undetonated piece of ordnance, just waiting for the excuse to go off. I described my call with Kevin Ladd's widow and got a theatrical moan in response. Did she really say all that?
My goodness, just extraordinary. Grief, you know, it deranges us. Deranges us completely. I'm just trying to find out why the book wasn't written. Of course, Kevin Ladd, that bad man, let's see. She paused, as if searching her memory. I suspected she could have told me immediately, but wanted to inject a little more drama into her day. Yes, that's it. He got in touch one day. He wrote to me. Mr. Could you remind me of your name again? Parr. Ben Parr. Mr. Parr. And he said he wouldn't be writing Sir John's biography after all. He didn't give a reason, and he enclosed a check for everything we'd paid him so far. I can assure you it was a very reasonable fee because we liked him a lot. I don't want to name a figure, but it was a handsome amount. We would have published the book and stood by him through any trouble. In a legal sense, you understand. But you can't do much when an author pays back their advance and stops answering their phone. It would have felt vindictive to sue. It was embarrassing, of course, but such is life. Embarrassment fades after all, and all we're left with is our conduct. Had Mr. Ladd done this before? Not once. I hate to say this about him, because we washed our hands of him. Professional pride, a terrible thing, but the thing is, he truly was among the best. Dogged, never afraid to go to court. In 40 years, I never saw him caught out on a matter of fact. It was a complete surprise, a shock. Was there a legal challenge? Not at all. Anyway, Kevin had had the frighteners put on him before and always remained pretty unmoved, so either Pemberley managed to find a longer and more powerful lever for his leverage, if you like, or the reason was something else. But he never contacted us again. That was his last work, as far as I know. Could Pemberley have contacted Ladd directly? I doubt it. If Sir John had been planning any legal scare tactics, his lawyers would have sent them to us rather than to Kevin. He's not eccentric, as far as I can tell, or at least not in that way. He would do it all as scrupulously as possible. He's reputed to have quite beautiful manners. I thought of Kara working for this man she thought was the greatest in the world, a man with beautiful manners who could stop inquiries about him with a wave of his hand. Abigail Turner interrupted my thoughts to ask me the same question Ladd's widow had done. Why do you want to know all this, incidentally? I told her I was a journalist looking into Pemberley for a story. She seemed convinced and gave me a florid farewell, telling me to ring any time, day or night, if I needed help again. Then she rang off. The queue for the coach had died down now, and the low murmur of voices echoing around the chamber had diminished too, replaced by the grinding noises of the huge unknown machines that ran the place. I shouldered my bags and walked to the gate. The northern outskirts of the city prompted a strange calm in me. Here, the street containing our first grim basement studio after my return from Florence. Here, the parade of shops Kara and I had lived above until her first well-paid posting. My work and Kara, the only two elements of my life that mattered. We had argued a lot before she left for the island. The first row was because she had been back from her previous job just 6 weeks before she went away again. I knew her work as an executive assistant demanded agility and compromise, but we had agreed we would spend more time together after her last job had come to an end. When, after 2 weeks back, she told me she was interviewing for a post starting in just a month, I lost my temper. I accused her of valuing her work above our life together, and she said her work was what allowed our life together and the prospect of a better future. She was right, of course, but in her anger, she also brought up the one subject guaranteed to hurt me most. She asked me when I would know it was time to give up art and take more reliable employment. We had discussed the matter before, but I had always been the one to bring it up first, in the middle of some crisis of confidence, and she had always encouraged me. This time, she did not. She told me that if recent years were anything to judge by, I would live out my career producing substandard work, growing unhappier all the while, neither following what I thought was my calling nor earning enough to justify ignoring that call. We made up, of course, but it took several days for me to feel calm when I looked at her. Clearly, I still hadn't forgotten her words, because in their own way, they were true. She had spotted the fact that for years I had not been producing work of the quality I knew. Somehow, I was capable of. I tried to conceal it, but I knew I had still not painted anything I could be proud of. Not yet. And that time was running short. I knew where the compromise came from. We both worked for the overclass, for the small percentage of people who lived in villages. No matter how much time I might give to schools in the city, my money came from private commissions for village dwellers. Pemberley, entirely unwitting, was the facilitator of the way I live now. Kara, of course, worked for an even smaller subset of my clientele, the ones who ran the businesses that owned the world. A vision occurred to me now and then, of a walled citadel on the side of a hill, fashioned of pure white stone glinting in the sunshine. The streets and courtyards and porticos of the city contain nothing but statues, beautiful, flawless statues of crystal, people, and all of these required maintenance. Kara and I both spent our days in the city, scurrying from corridor to courtyard, through alleys and up staircases, in the service of these statues, never resting. Where we disagreed, of course, was on why we did it. I did it to build a life for myself elsewhere, somewhere vital and messy and difficult. Kara dreamed of elevation to the citadel itself. She had a pedestal in mind, and one day she would ascend it, take her pose, and be frozen in place forever. I lacked the heart to tell her we would never make it. The citadel almost never took new members. The principal qualification for entry was to be made of crystal already, and I feared her reaction when this unstated difference between us became plain to her. Perhaps it already had done, and that was why she had left. These were the thoughts that occupied me on the journey from the heart of the city. That was a passage from Andrew Hunter Murray's novel, The Sanctuary. You've been listening to The Big Snore. Until next time.